Hi, and welcome to Diaries of Social Data Research, a podcast where we take a deeper look into the research diaries of interdisciplinary collaborations.
We're your hosts, Lucy Lee and Katie Keith.
Hello and welcome. Today we have two distinguished guests, Ryan Gallagher and Brooke Foucault-Wells. Ryan Gallagher is a PhD candidate in network science at Northeastern University. He identifies as a computational social scientist studying online political communication and how people amplify their voices through network spaces. His research has made methodological advances in network science and answered some fundamental questions about the networked public sphere. He is the founder and core organizer of the Network Justice Satellite Symposium at Networks 2021. And prior to Northwestern, he received a Master of Science in Mathematics from the University of Vermont and a BA in Mathematics from the University of Connecticut. Welcome, Ryan.
Thank you very much for having me.
Our second guest is Brooke Foucault-Wells, who is an associate professor in the Department of Communication Studies, a core faculty member of the Network Science Institute, and director of the Communication, Media, and Marginalization Lab at Northeastern University. Her research focuses on how online communication networks enable and constrain behavior, with a particular emphasis on how these networks enable the pursuit of individual, team, and collective goals. She serves on the editorial board of the journals Web Science and Social Media Plus Society. She's also the co-author of Hashtag Activism, Networks of Race and Gender Justice, which was published in March 2020. She earned her PhD from the School of Communication at Northwestern University in Media, Technology, and Society, and an undergraduate and MS degrees in communication from Cornell University. Welcome, Brooke.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Today, we'll be discussing their 2019 CSCW paper, Reclaiming Stigmatized Narratives, the Network Disclosure Landscape of Hashtag MeToo. Along with Ryan and Brooke, co-authors on this paper include Elizabeth Stoll and Andrea G. Parker. As a content warning for our listeners, this article discusses issues of sexual violence against women. This paper analyzes a network of tweets containing disclosures of personal experiences with sexual violence, containing the hashtag MeToo on Twitter. The authors qualitatively code a sample of tweets, create a predictive classifier using these codes to find disclosures, and map the interaction networks of MeToo users. Their dataset of 1.8 million tweets showcase a variety of experiences. They found that an individual who saw more disclosures prior to disclosing were more likely to share details with their disclosure. In addition, subnetworks between those who disclosed are twice as dense compared to subnetworks between those who did not. Overall, network-level reciprocal disclosures reduce stigma and increase solidarity and social support around this topic. Is there anything else that I missed? There was so much in this paper, so I just picked out a couple things, but if there's anything you think you need to add, please do.
No, I think that's perfect. It's a good summary of what we did.
So to start out, can you give us a little background for our listeners who might not know much about the Me Too movement and how that led possibly into the idea you had for this paper?
Yeah, so I can take that one. This paper was part of a larger project at Northeastern funded by our Global Resilience Institute. So I had applied with a couple of co-authors or collaborators to study how social media in particular helps women be resilient in the world, broadly speaking. We kind of did a few different analyses of things like the women's movement and marches and so on. The project wasn't quite coming together in the way we wanted. So often you have a good idea, but matching a good idea with data is where it gets tricky. And so it was in working with Ryan, who at the time, I believe, was a first year student, all right, that we came up with this idea to study the Me Too hashtag and the intricacies of the networks that formed around the hashtag. And I'll kick it over to Ryan. He's actually the one who kind of discovered the data set and had the idea of how to work with it.
Yeah, so to put this in context, I started my PhD in 2017, which is when Me Too kind of took off that October. And so as Brooke said, you know, we're kind of playing around with different ideas. We had kind of been talking about women's social movements. And my spring semester, I took a social networks class and I took a research design class, and we had to kind of come up with research projects that we would do for that. So one was more like a lit review, and one was more like a, you know, how would you actually do research? And I had read this book by Mario Small, who, what's it called? I think it's Someone to Talk To. And it really emphasizes this idea of people disclosing to folks who are weak ties, so people they might not be close to, and how this kind of thing can come up a lot more than we might think it does. And so I really had that kind of going on in my head, and Me Too had happened the previous fall, and I was trying to come up with a way to kind of really put them together. So I played around with that in the spring, and it was in the summer that I attended the Summer Institute in Computational Social Science. And there I met a friend and peer, Jeffrey Lockhart, at the University of Michigan. And he actually had collected Me Too data around the time that, you know, it had taken off. So I think one of the major issues we're running into is we're network scientists. We want to say something about the networks of Me Too. But it's really hard to say things about networks when you only have like a small sample of the data. And that's all we had at the time. We had like 10% of Twitter or something like that, I believe. And so we've been struggling kind of on this data front of how to deal with that. But Jeff had collected everything at the time. So he had a full sample, and he was very kind, and he shared the tweet IDs for that, and I was able to use that to rehydrate the tweets and get our data set that is behind the paper. And I think that really, once it became possible, we actually started to be able to ask more questions.
So in this paper, you use a lot of key terms, including, so the three that we kind of pulled out were hashtag activism, network level reciprocal disclosures, and network counterpublics. Could you tell us a little bit about these three terms and what they mean for our audience?
Yeah, I'm glad you pulled those three out, because they are sort of, two of them are me and one of them's Ryan. So it's the perfect combination. So for a while prior to this project, I had been studying online activism more broadly. And together with my co-author, Sarah Jackson and Moya Bailey, we discovered this phenomenon where not always, but sometimes, people who don't normally have access to mainstream media or have a lot of influence in the general mainstream public sphere are able to harness social media and come together around hashtags to create social change. So Me Too is an example of that. The other obvious example is Black Lives Matter. And then there are zillions of others that we talk about in our book, Hashtag Activism. But with this idea, we wanted to kind of intervene in the literature on online activism, which at the time when we were starting to write was really pretty dismissive of the power of online activism. There was a lot of framing of that as being lazy activism or disengaged activism or performative in some way. And we wanted to do a pretty full-throated pushback on that and say, look, you know, that may well be true. I'm not going to deny that some of this is performative and some of it is pretty meaningless. At the same time, there are groups of people who don't have other kinds of political access. You're making assumptions about the sorts of things people can and should be doing for a variety of reasons when you say that online activism is illegitimate. And those people are the networked counterpublics. So that was kind of our theoretical intervention to say counterpublics are in offline spaces, collections of marginalized folk who come together in order to coalesce on issues and then try to intervene in mainstream conversations to change what people are talking about. And we noticed, and I think others had noticed as well, that this happens online as well. So the networked counterpublic is that collection of marginalized folks coming together online. And there's this really interesting thing that happens when it happens online. So people might not know each other. We might have a lot of weak ties, or people coalesce, and the way that they coalesce is often through the hashtag. So people find the hashtag first and they find each other second. And that's pretty different. So it's different than, say, joining a social club and then discussing with other people and then coming together on your issue. And so that's where my sort of rejoinder to the hashtag activism dismissal is that look, you know, for some kinds of people in some situations, this is a powerful tool and it's created dramatic social change. I mean, it's easy to forget that even 10 years ago, we weren't really talking about racial justice in mainstream white America. We weren't really talking about gender justice in mainstream America either. So the ways that those conversations have shifted around these hashtags has been potent and powerful. And then Ryan can fill you in on this kind of last theoretical concept that really brought the paper together.
Yeah, so in this way that a lot of Brooke's work has been about how folks come together into these networks, you know, you end up with these networks that are really big online. They're these really kind of big masses. And I think as we were entering this project with Me Too, something we're trying to balance is when you're thinking about Me Too and it's about disclosure is this very kind of personal and dyadic thing. You know, it happens usually between one person and another, if at all. And so I came into this project trying to figure out, you know, how do we kind of bring together this idea of we have these really big networks, we have something like Me Too that emerged, but we also have this thing that's very personal and kind of intimate that usually happens on this really small level. And just through kind of going through the prior work, I came across this paper from Nazanin Adelibi and Andrea Forte. And they introduced this idea of network level reciprocal disclosure. And so they were looking at, they did interviews with women who had experienced pregnancy loss and who had disclosed it on Facebook. And they were kind of going through the reasons that different folk disclose that pregnancy loss, because it's another stigmatized experience, just like experienced sexual violence. And there's all sorts of reasons that folks do that. But one that popped out to me was this idea of network level reciprocal disclosure. And so the idea is that they were on Facebook and they saw a friend who had experienced pregnancy loss. That person shared that. And by seeing that, that made them feel more comfortable to share their own experience of pregnancy loss. And so I saw this and I was like, this might be kind of the key of how to tie this together, because it kind of had this network level view that we were going for and how to start tying this together into something that can merge into a networked counterpublic, into, you know, a network that organizes around a hashtag. And so that was really kind of, I think, the major theoretical kind of move that we were able to make to bring those two different literatures together.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it sounds like it's this really unique combination of sort of network data analysis along with, you know, studying activism in the social media space and online, which leads us to asking about how the collaboration for this specific paper formed. So one of the things we like to highlight on our podcast is people coming from different backgrounds collaborating together. So you're both coming from network science and then also communication, but two of your co-authors are coming from the Wellness Technology Lab and I think the College of Computer Science and Health Sciences. So can you walk through when and how these collaborations formed and how you all brought your own expertise to the table?
Yeah, so Andrea Parker is a person that I've known since graduate school. She's a faculty member at Georgia Tech now. And she and I had been collaborating on other projects around kind of health and wellness technology topics. You know, when Ryan approached me with this particular data set, frankly, I knew that we were out of our league, right? So I study activism and we can do the computational analyses and I'm confident we can do a good job with that. But the kind of thing that we were talking about and the kind of topic that people were disclosing on was really a public health issue. Right? And I did not think that we alone could do justice to that. So neither one of us has that particular background. So I approached Andrea and she just so happened to have Elizabeth was her student at the time. And not only does Elizabeth have the public health background, but she specifically had been doing volunteer work with the Boston Area Rape Crisis Center. So she was specifically in communication with survivors on a regular basis. And that to me felt like the right combination, that I felt comfortable moving forward with the project on sexual assault when we had someone, you know, who could be sensitive to the activism, the implications of the activism, who could be sensitive to the amplification and the complications around technological amplification, who knew about the public health and the consequences for wellness and well-being, and who could treat survivors or the stories of survivors with the care and compassion that they deserve.
Yeah, and I think so that's, you know, exactly how kind of the collaboration emerged. And I'd say, you know, so as the other graduate student who was on this paper, you know, Elizabeth did a lot of the work with me. You can kind of see a clear line in the paper that kind of splits the qualitative and quantitative part, but the quantitative part is not possible at all without the qualitative part. And so methodologically, that's where Elizabeth made huge contributions, because I was not trained as someone who could really kind of read, you know, 2000 tweets about Me Too and pull apart the themes. So she really directed that. We had several undergraduate RAs that worked with us. She worked with them to do all the kind of hand coding that underlies the whole project.
So to talk a little bit more about methods. So this paper uses a mixed methods analysis. Like you mentioned, there's the qualitative and the quantitative. And sometimes in computational social science, data science, et cetera, we tend to privilege the quantitative over the qualitative, unfortunately. So I kind of want to talk about like the decisions you made to determine what methods you wanted to use for this project. And did you foresee needing all of these methods ahead of time?
I think we did have a good sense of what we would need to do. And it kind of came down to this idea, if we wanted to map how disclosures had happened in Me Too, we would need to be able to have some kind of way of saying what is a disclosure and what's not. And the only way that we would be able to really do that is if we sat down and we read a lot of tweets and we kind of put together what a disclosure was and what wasn't. And so, kind of at the heart of all the computational stuff is just, you know, we at some point labeled what is a disclosure and what's not in Me Too. But as we were kind of going through that, we did a full-on qualitative content analysis. So we kind of mapped out all of the themes of Me Too. And I think that really helped us as we went forward in a couple of ways. So on kind of the practical way, you know, we ended up reading 2,500 tweets about Me Too. And so when it came to make a, you know, machine learning classifier, which is just, you know, logistic regression, we needed features to tell us, you know, what are we going to use to say this is a disclosure and what's not. After you read that many tweets, you have a sense of the language that people use. And so all of the features that we use in logistic regression, they weren't like derived automatically how a lot of papers might do. We sat down in a room with a whiteboard and we wrote out every single phrase that we thought could be relevant. And we put them into these different categories and, you know, why we think they should contribute something. And that would not have been possible if we had not read all those tweets. It was almost easy though, having done that after. So it really kind of gave us a domain knowledge to bring towards making the machine learning classifier. But I think the other thing too, though, is the quantitative analysis here can only go so far. And the major thing is that, you know, at the end of the day, we want to say something about how Me Too affected how folks disclosed. But what we really can never say anything about is we don't know who could have disclosed but did not. And so there's a point where like our quantitative analysis does fall short of a full-on kind of, you know, causal inference approach. And so the way that I look at the qualitative part of this paper is it really helps us triangulate kind of the rest of the story. You know, so we read the tweets. We know people said that they disclosed because they saw other people disclosing. And so the way I kind of interpret the paper is instead of, you know, we did this one direct approach towards showing something, is rather we use a kind of host of methods to triangulate something about what happened with Me Too.
I think that's spot on. And I'll just underscore this pairing and exactly as you say, often on the computational side, folks will dismiss the qualitative work as either kind of in service of the computational work or somehow lesser than. And I think actually, to be fair, the same is true in the other direction, that sometimes folks will dismiss the computational work as not being able to provide evidence in the way that qualitative work can. But it, for me, the kind of signature move of my lab is the pairing of the two, the understanding the computational impact of hashtags like this help us tell part of the story, but then understanding what people are saying adds the layers of nuance into the story that we really need in order to make strong claims and appropriately scoped claims about things like activism and social change.
Yeah, to follow up on that, I was really struck by the discussion you put in the paper about why you didn't use automatic text features such as topic models or document embeddings, and how instead you purposely opted for these handcrafted features, which, I think speaks to this broader trade-off in applied work that is trading off these flashier or newer methods with something that seems maybe simpler but could have better predictive accuracy or is possibly more reliable or is possibly more relevant for the domain. So for our listeners who maybe didn't catch the nuance of that, could you iterate on what did it look like discussions between your group of how to actually approach the modeling here and why you opted for this sort of simpler but more straightforward method?
Yeah, so at the end of the day, we're handling a really sensitive thing, right? We are predicting if someone disclosed during Me Too, which is equivalent to predicting if someone is a survivor of sexual violence. And that's a really sensitive thing. And so one thing that really comes out and kind of in disclosures and reading about disclosures, you can kind of break them up into two types almost, is there's direct disclosures where someone basically says what's going on, and there's indirect disclosures. And I think we ended up kind of just making a choice is, we're going to focus on direct disclosures here. That's what people are putting out there, and that's what we feel most comfortable classifying. And so you can imagine there's all sorts of other ways that folks indirectly disclose through Me Too. They might have said certain kind of things that, wasn't saying it outright, but kind of alluded to it. I think a lot of folks, they retweeted a tweet that only had hashtag Me Too, which could be an indicator of an indirect disclosure. And so these kind of other ways that people could have disclosed. And I think that's something that is possible, something more advanced, like a topic model or word embedding or a document embedding, whatever, could pick up on. And that was not what we were trying to do. And so I think that's why we elected to kind of go with these straightforward kind of linguistic features that more or less if someone used them, they would probably have a high chance of indicating they were directly disclosing. So really putting the emphasis on those direct disclosures rather than the indirect disclosures.
I'll also add that we spend in the lab and on this project a great deal of time thinking through the ethics of a project, including talking a lot about how we're not going to even do a project because we don't think it's ethical. And I think this is a thing, we're starting to catch on to the kind of back-end ethics, the after the fact, was this a good idea or not a good idea? And the front-end ethics have been there for a while. So do we need consent or do we not need consent? But it's important to me as a scholar studying these sensitive topics to think about ethics as woven through every stage of the process. So if we think about, like Ryan said, what are we really doing here? We are observing without direct permission. Perhaps we have implied permission because it's on Twitter, but maybe not even that. We are observing folks talking about their experiences of surviving sexual assault. And to me, if someone's saying that very directly, that's very different than if they're kind of whispering it in the back of the room. So we're just going to ignore the whispers in the back of the room. And it doesn't make it worse science. I would argue that it makes it more ethical science moving forward.
So diving into this topic of ethics, there are multiple points in the paper where you're thinking about it throughout, and we can actually sense that when we're reading the paper. Like there's this moment where you talk about how you're not going to indicate which tweets you identified are disclosures to avoid having a public list of that. You didn't release your classifier, stuff like that. Could you tell us a little bit more about like maybe even just the classifier one? Did you not release it because of potential dual use? And like, how did you have these discussions with your collaborators?
Yeah, I think what might be most instructive to talk about is how we actually ended up releasing what data we did for this and how we did that, because I would say it's not usual for a, you know, quote unquote Twitter study. Right, and you know, so as we've said, you know, we have this sensitive data set. It's about Me Too in general. We know some portion of all those folks who tweeted Me Too were disclosing, and you know, by reading through them, we know a considerable portion of them were disclosures. And the thing about this paper is we outline very specifically, you know, our appendix has exactly what features we use in the classifier, you know, how to identify a disclosure, at least in this moment in Me Too. So that was part of the reason I'm not releasing kind of the training data, you know, the things that we labeled as disclosures or not, because that would make it a lot easier for someone to abuse it. So even if we didn't release the classifier, all they have to do is, you know, pick up their favorite machine learning, you know, package and just type in a few words and they'd be able to apply it to more tweets. And I think that was the thing we were trying to avoid, is you don't want to make it easy for someone to abuse this. So it is not necessarily easy for someone to go and label all of their own data and then use our classifier and abuse it. And so that was, I think that was kind of the major thing that we were trying to do, is to make it harder for someone to abuse anything that we did. And so that showed up in multiple ways. One of the ways was not releasing the classifier. One of the ways was not releasing the training data. And one of the ways was not directly releasing the tweet IDs. So, you know, if you're not familiar, for anyone who's not familiar, usually if you want to kind of have open data with Twitter studies, what you do is you're not allowed to share raw Twitter data, but you can share tweet IDs. And those tweet IDs can be used to return kind of the raw Twitter data. And what we ended up doing, we had a couple discussions about this. We were trying to kind of decide the right way. You know, we want to be advocates of open science, but it's difficult when we're in the space of, you know, our marginalized groups, sexual violence, hashtag activism, surveillance, things like that. So we wanted to balance these kinds of things. And what we ended up doing was not releasing it publicly for everyone to use, and not kind of not releasing it at all, is we ended up working with the University of Michigan runs a data sharing service, which is kind of hosted through the Institute. I don't remember the name off the top of my head, but this is they have full staff that works on this and everything. And you can submit your data sets to them, and they will, for certain kind of sensitive data sets, administer, folks have to submit certain information in order to get access to the data set. So I believe to get access to our tweet IDs for this project, they need to submit something like an IRB, or at least have IRB exception, and also plan for what they plan to do with the tweets. And there's agreement, you know, that they won't do certain things like re-identify in certain kinds of ways. And so this is kind of a walled garden approach that I learned from Matt Salganik. And I think this was a nice balance between not having any transparency on the research and, you know, just putting the tweets out there, which could have led to someone abusing it.
So one of the things I think that happens when there's a kind of spectacular ethical debacle with computational data is that the researchers will say, well, that's not how we intended for people to use it. And I 100% believe that that's true, that, that, you know, many, if not all, computational scholars are trying to do some good in the world, and they don't intend to hurt people. And at the same time, in order to not hurt people, you have to spend time imagining all the ways that people could be hurt by data like these and analyses like these, and having people who are contextual experts in how people have in fact been hurt by data like these. So I remember in one of these conversations, Elizabeth describing how a lot of survivors of sexual violence are also survivors of domestic violence, right? And so there we're kind of twinning these problematic behaviors, and we can imagine very easily how an abusive partner could use data like these in order to track down where someone was at a particular point in time. And it's not that, say, the same abusive partner couldn't go search Twitter anyway, but if we bring to light the extra attention that someone is disclosing the experience of sexual violence, then suddenly we kind of hone in. We're making it just that much easier for someone to use this in a bad way. So, you know, that's just a long way of saying that it is part of our responsibility as computational researchers to do the work of imagining, right, where the harms might come in, and then to pair our ethical practices and our, including, you know, the balance of data sharing and data privacy with those kinds of imaginations in mind.
So follow up on that question. You know, both Lucy and I are trained as computer scientists, right? And I'll be the first one to admit that I think part of my training lacked sort of this emphasis on these personal experiences and remembering whose data it is, because we're trained instead to look at abstract population level trends. So can you share with myself, but also other listeners who want to, you know, do better practice of, what strategies do you have for, again, keeping what you said in sight, that these personal experiences of real people that you're studying do matter, and how to, it seems almost like climbing over that empathy wall. So yeah, specific strategies you have?
Sure. So the first and foremost, I think it has to be a checkpoint in every stage of the process. So you sit down and really think about it. So what are the ethics of even doing this project? Is it a project that needs to be done? Is it a project that is going to benefit the people who are probably unbeknownst to them participating by creating, having generated the data that you're using? You know, then if the answers to those things are yes, and they often are, then checking again after you collect the data. Like, have we collected it in a way that is keeping with what we think that the participants might expect? And then after you analyze the data, are these results safe or not safe for the people in the study? And so on. And in each step of the way, I think this is the hard part. And I understand and empathize a lot, particularly for junior scholars. It's hard to abandon a project, especially after you put some time into it. But at each step of the way, if you really want to be ethical, you have to be willing to abandon the project, because sometimes the most ethical thing to do is to not do the work at all.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's very much about taking ethics as a methods very seriously. And when you do ethics as methods, that really means it needs to be throughout the entire project, not just at the end as a post hoc kind of explanation. And I just also emphasize, I think this is where it really helps to be doing the qualitative work. You are reading these people's stories and you really have a sense of like much better of what you're saying. It's very hard to kind of divorce yourself from what you're studying when you've read so many of these tweets. And I remember having, you know, sessions with Elizabeth on this, where we'd read, you know, hundreds of these tweets. Many of them are just describing terrible things. And we'd have to sit back and, you know, like debrief between ourselves to say like, wow, this really sucks. And so I think it really emphasizes, you know, the importance of doing these mixed methods work. The qualitative work really keeps you closer to the data. And it's not easy. I think that's what kind of gets overlooked a little bit sometimes by quantitative folks. It's like, oh, you're just reading tweets. It's like, no, this is hard. It's hard to kind of read these tweets. It's hard to be close to these stories, but we're doing this so that we can kind of hopefully produce something that's helpful.
One thing I've seen becoming more and more popular, even in the computational literature, is these positionality statements, which I think is good practice. You can kind of Google that for examples, but it is this habit of disclosing, even in writing in the paper, where you come to this project from. So the kinds of questions you asked us to start the podcast, you know, what was your interest in the project? What kinds of work have you done before? And who are you as a person to be doing this work? And I think that practice is helpful for the empathy building. It helps you see where you are, where the gaps are. And it also reminds us that all of this work, including computational work, or maybe especially computational work, is not in fact as objective as we like to make it out to be. That we're always making choices, and we can make choices that prioritize certain people's needs over other needs. We can make choices that prioritize certain kinds of outcomes and profits and so on over others. And so keeping that kind of front of mind and revising that positionality statement as you go can be a nice way of reminding yourself where you are coming from with this project and where you want it to end up.
So a big key word of this whole podcast is interdisciplinary work. And Northeastern's Network Science Institute is maybe an exemplar in my head of interdisciplinary work. And to review the bios we presented at the beginning, Brooke comes from a communications background, Ryan comes from a math background. And so could each of you tell us a little bit about how you ended up at this intersection at Northwestern working together?
I can try to say something towards this. So I did my undergraduate degree in mathematics, and I went on to do a master's in math. I kind of had this crossroads when I was graduating undergrad, whether I wanted to basically theoretical math or applied math. I chose applied math because, you know, I wanted to be doing something, you know, I had a sense of like how to read statistics and things like that. I wanted to be able to apply that knowledge. And so when I went to my master's at the University of Vermont, I worked with the Computational Story Lab with Chris Danforth and Peter Dodds. And that was really my kind of first foray into computational social science. And my first semester there, I did a project on Black Lives Matter and All Lives Matter, which was kind of the trending thing at that time. And as I was working on that project, you know, so I did a lot of text analysis for this, but as I was working on it, one of the papers I kept coming back to was one from Brooke and her co-author Sarah Jackson, which was on this kind of case study of my NYPD, and is one of their first papers on this idea of networked counterpublics. And so it helped kind of ground my thoughts. And as I worked on this project, I realized it's a lot harder to do computational social science than I thought it was. And so I kind of came out of that project like, wow, like I kind of have the computational down, but the social science part is a lot harder than I thought it is. And as I was looking towards what I wanted to do next, you know, I had this paper really at the backbone of my work, and I hadn't realized though she was right down at Northeastern. So I was in Burlington, Vermont, Boston, Massachusetts. That is not that far. And I, you know, they had this network science PhD program, and I was like, oh, that looks kind of cool. You know, like I think at the time I still kind of wanted to do text analysis more than networks. So I was like, it looks interdisciplinary enough that they'll actually keep letting me do text analysis. But networks are cool too. You know, I was doing complex system stuff at the University of Vermont. And that's basically how I ended up applying for the program and getting in. And that's how we kind of kicked it off. And so a lot of my journey through the PhD, I'm in my final semester now. I'm on my fifth year. I think my journey through this program is, you know, I've learned computational things, but it's really been, you know, how do you be a social scientist? How do you take, when you say you're a computational social scientist, how do you take computational seriously and how do you take social science seriously in that? So that was kind of my trajectory towards this interdisciplinary relationship I have with my advisor.
So interestingly, my background is basically the exact opposite. So I have been a communication major the whole way through since the first day of my freshman year until the last day of my PhD. And I, without disclosing my exact age, the hot topic when I was an undergrad was this new kind of communication people were doing on the internet. So I was really interested in the idea of people forming relationships with folks that they had never met before. So what would that mean to have a relationship online? I spent a little bit of time working in the tech industry and was pretty enamored of the idea that the technology was moving fast enough that we would be able to one day have full-fledged, fully mediated relationships with people that may maybe never meet face-to-face, which was a really novel idea in the early 2000s. We all know the kind of punchline, right? So that turns out to be a really important subdiscipline in communication studies now. And as things like social media and other kinds of online communication took off, it just almost became necessary to learn the computational tools to handle the data. There were just too much of it to, I mean, you literally like couldn't put it in an Excel spreadsheet, you'd run out of rows. And so I was the world's most reluctant statistician and the world's most reluctant computer programmer. And to this day, I will say, I don't know how to code. It's not entirely true. I can like read code and change things around, but you know, I certainly have not in my life ever developed something from scratch. That's absolutely true. And so when I was invited to join the Network Science Institute as a first year assistant professor, I knew that I knew the social network stuff, but I wasn't quite convinced that I was a network scientist, right? So I had written a dissertation on online social networks, like, am I a network scientist? What is a network scientist? And so at the point at which Ryan came into my life, he submitted, I don't know if I've told this story to him before, but I wasn't planning on taking a student the year that he had applied. And he submitted this application at a time when I was writing about the Ferguson protests after Michael Brown was murdered, a kind of arguable start of the Black Lives Matter movement. He submitted this application that said, you know, I am, you know, I'm really strong in statistics, in programming, and I've dabbled around a little bit in race and gender studies. I wrote this paper on Black Lives Matter, and I think I would like to learn the social science, you know, to be able to do this really well. Like, well, that seems like a unicorn and a perfect match. So I said, yes, come join me. We'll figure it out. It's hard to get funding to do activism research, but we've figured it out along the way together. And really, really do, I mean, when we talk, I really do, I hope that I'm giving Ryan guidance that's helpful. And I know that he's giving me help on the statistics and the math and the kind of network science. So I think we grew together as network scientists. I think both now we would claim to be network scientists because we complement each other really well. And together we're able to produce this kind of work that is robust on the statistical side and also on the social science side.
Such exciting journeys, both of you. Dialing back a little bit to the paper, can you walk us through any major pitfalls or challenges and how you overcame these?
I'd say it was relatively smooth. I'd say like 85% of it, you know, so we submitted it to CSCW, you know, we got revisions and it got accepted eventually. And so that was really nice. Most of the project, once we had the data, came together really well. One thing that I was looking back through the paper right before this, and it's funny because it is one sentence in the paper. But one thing is that we got this data from my friend Jeff. I rehydrated it. I'm working with this data for several months. And it's only after several months that I happen to make a time series that is at a particular resolution. And I realize we are missing a whole 24 hours of data in here. There's just, it's like you see a time series, it's all wavy and then it just goes down and it's flat and then it goes back up. It's like, oh, that doesn't look natural. And this was a problem. It was a weird kind of problem because the thing is we were pretty sure it actually wouldn't affect the results. Like it was one of the latter days in Me Too, but we didn't feel like quite comfortable. You know, we couldn't submit a time series and really say like, oh, this is Me Too during the first few weeks or whatever. And so we needed to get that data. And the only way to get it was to buy it through Twitter. And this was, I feel like I don't even remember all the details of this debacle, but it was a lot harder than we thought it would be. Oh, and this was all related to, we had a whole other ethical conversation on scraping Twitter data to collect replies for this paper as well. I don't know, Brooke, Brooke was really kind of at the front of buying the Twitter data, so she might remember that a little better.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's just one of those things. And I, for the graduate students listening to this, I really empathize with the complications that arise when money gets involved in research or when you need money for research. And in this case, I'm grateful that Twitter has actually changed their policies on stuff like this. And they have a much better API for academic researchers and a much better set of tools and resources for folks who might find themselves in this situation. But essentially what we had was a fully written paper that we thought was good quality with this 24 hours missing. And I don't remember the specifics, but it was several thousand dollars worth of data in the end. And it is just not that easy to come up with several thousand dollars unattached to a grant or any other project. And so we did, we hustled and I begged for money from different parts of the institution and put it together. But these are the kinds of things, you know, when people ask, like, why does it take so long to get a good social science or computational social science paper done? Or why does it take so long to get a good dissertation done? It's like, well, we sunk probably 2 months of our life into figuring out how to buy one day's worth of tweets.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about the actual publication process. So, like, how did you decide on CSCW? And then what was kind of the feedback you got from reviewers? And did you revise, resubmit, and how did you respond?
So we decided on CSCW in collaboration with our co-authors, so Elizabeth and Andrea. They are kind of much more in the HCI space than us. So they regularly publish in things like CHI and CSCW. And I think we were kind of fine going that route, because it would still help. I think we basically decided because it would still help my CV. Basically, I've known since I started the PhD program that I probably wanted to apply to jobs in both communication and like information science. And this would be a publication that would kind of be a check mark for information science. You know, folks would be able to look at CCW and like, oh, that's a nice paper. And so I think that's how we decided on the venue. You know, I was happy. I was also kind of excited. It was my first paper submitted to a conference. I hadn't done that before. I'd only submitted to journals. And then the review process was not too bad. I believe I remember the reviews we got were quite positive. And the feedback that we did get kind of pushed us to... We had to tone back, so we had some of our language was a little too aggressive on like the causality. So we toned that back, which I think that was like, I just made a bad word choice somewhere in a couple places. And then I think the other major, we made major edits, I'd say, to the discussion. And I think that's where they kind of the reviewers pushed us to is like a lot more on like, what does this mean? You know, how do we kind of, what do we do with this kind of ethically as HCI researchers and things like that. So I'd say kind of the causality and the kind of fleshing out the discussion was what we got back from the viewers. And when we resubmitted it, we got that kind of, you know, the provisional accept.
Anything to add, Brooke?
I will say Ryan's being a little humble. So the other thing that we, as folks who often publish in social science journals, get really used to is writing incredibly elaborate responses to reviewers. And I get the impression, based on the reaction that we got, that the CSCW reviewers weren't necessarily expecting. So I think one of them was kind of harping on the ethics, which, you know, we appreciate, but the kinds of critiques that they were making, we had not only fully considered, but had gone well beyond. And I think Ryan wrote like a 4-page response to the kind of ethical conundrum that they were pointing out. So
I forgot about this. I genuinely enjoy really writing like exceptionally long responses to reviews. I just find it really fun. So I think like the full reply to the reviews that we submitted was almost as long as the paper itself. It was like 30 pages or so, including, you know, like quoting them and then quoting what we changed and all of that. And so I think I think in the final set of reviews, we had one reviewer say something like, I've never seen such a thorough reply to the reviews ever before. So that was kind of a, I took that as a compliment.
I think so.
So what is one big takeaway from each of you from this project that has either fed into future papers or you hope will feed into future papers?
I think for me, this paper was a really important stepping stone in my research career because I think it was the first project where I really brought together qualitative and quantitative methods. And that I really tried very hard to tie it to the theory too. Because the theory too is kind of a, we were trying to tie together like multiple streams and we had this kind of disclosure in general. We had the network level reciprocal disclosure, and then we had the hashtag activism. And so I'm really proud of this paper because for me, it was the first time that I was able to really show at least how I had grown since the beginning of my master's. So this was accepted. I think, you know, it was submitted sometime during my second year. I think it was accepted towards the beginning of my third year. And so in that, you know, 4 or 5 years between the time I started as a master's in mathematics at the University of Vermont, and I was doing, you know, just much less substantive kind of research on Black Lives Matter and All Lives Matter, you know, that I am glad that I did that paper, but at times I think that it is a little lacking in certain ways. And so this paper was kind of my first chance to reboot and say, look, here's what I can do as a computational social scientist. And I've really tried to just do this quality of work since then. So it was an important kind of milestone, I think, in my research career.
For me, I'll always be grateful to have had this team working with these data, because prior to this, my kind of ethical compromise on how to deal with Twitter data was to only focus on the most prominent users in a given network, which, you know, there are some question marks about whether or not that's ethical, but these are people whose tweets had, you know, in most cases, hundreds of thousands of likes and retweets and replies and so on. So these folks knew full well that the tweets were getting attention. So I felt like that was okay. In this case, a lot of the tweets that we were handling didn't have all that much engagement, that there was a reasonable expectation that people didn't know that researchers were looking at them or that lots of strangers were looking at them. And so to have had the opportunity to work through the ethics of that and how to handle it and whether or not it was a good idea with a set of scholars who also think really thoughtfully and empathetically about what to do has now become a model moving forward. So there are some kinds of questions that I wouldn't have touched before because I would have been afraid of how to present the results in a way that honors the folks who are generating the data. And that now I feel more confident about those kinds of questions.
I would add too, I also agree. I think one of the other things I took away from this, it was my first chance to really kind of have these questions on the ethics of doing research. And it was a really good group to do it with, I think exactly because we weren't always on the same page. There was room for pushback. You know, some of us were a little more conservative. Some of us were a little more kind of loose with what we were okay with and what we weren't. And being able to have those discussions, really try to articulate why we felt like, you know, our particular position was ethical or not, or, you know, or why it was ethical. I'm not arguing to do unethical stuff. Was really, I think, formative. And so I think in a lot of the papers we've written since then too, at least when I am a lead author, so I really try to bring out the ethics part, you know, to as almost like an ethics section rather than just a few sentences.
So we're nearing the end of our recording session, and this was such a joy to talk to both of you. Is there anything else that you want to just mention before we end that we didn't cover?
No, One thing that I just want to put out into the world, especially for folks who are computationally minded, is I made a kind of opaque reference to how it's a little bit difficult to get funding for research like this. And I think that there is a tendency, particularly for folks who are getting computational training, to think in these very neoliberal capitalist frameworks. So what is going to have impact in terms of generating more capital? And questions like this don't necessarily generate funding. They don't necessarily generate insights that are marketable. They don't generate new apps or insights that are particularly interesting to social media companies, and yet they're so vitally important. And so I would just urge folks to think about ways, if not to focus on questions of social good and public import, all the time, to weave that into your practice. I think we need 1,000 more people working on questions like these, maybe 1 million more people working on questions like these, because there's real harm happening in the world. And one way to offset that harm is to take our skills as computational scientists and bring them to bear on creating more justice and more good with the data that we have access to.
Brian, anything else?
I don't think I can articulate it any better than that.
Well, thank you both so much for taking the time for this conversation. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It's been really fun to be able to talk about this paper with people.
Yeah, thanks for the invitation. This has been great.